Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Phoenix, Arizona, it's time for Valley Business Radio, spotlighting the Valley's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Hello and welcome to Valley Business Radio, where we tell the stories that traditional media tends to ignore and help connect you to the right people. I'm your host, Dr. Adrian McIntyre, and I'm joined in the studio today by a fun group of folks from Esperanza, improving health and restoring hope around the world. And in our own backyard is the theme of our show today. Welcome, Jerry Royce, President of Esperanza.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here. Anna Ortiz, you are the International Program Director. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Maria Valenzuela, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
So, Jerry, tell us a little bit about the organization, about Esperanza, how it's been around here in Arizona for a while. What is the story?
Esperanza was founded 49 years ago and has been working to improve health outcomes for people in the poorest communities, both here in our backyard and internationally.
That's great. When did you get involved in the organization?
I started with Esperanza in summer of 2017, and I've been working as CEO officially since March of 18.
Now, tell us a little bit about the mission of the organization, the scope of your programs. Maria, you're the domestic program director. Anna, you're the international program director. So I'm imagining there's a lot going on. Jerry, what is the kind of scale of this outfit here?
Our work really happens in two camps. So locally, we do health education, disease prevention. We work with the low-income Latino communities, families, men, women, and children, and seniors. We help them to improve their health outcomes through healthy eating, exercise, oral health, and Maria's crew really does that. Our bilingual, bicultural community health workers, our health educators, are the ones that deliver that work. And then on the international side, we work in Peru, Nicaragua, Ecuador, Bolivia, and Mozambique. And we do two fronts, community development with a strategic partner in that country who really is on the ground delivering the services, as well as medical and surgical missions, where we send U.S. teams into the country to do surgeries.
Which came first, the domestic work or the international work?
International work came first. Our founder was a young Navy officer, and his ship landed, he was on an icebreaker, and it set into port in the Amazon, and he saw the utter poverty and despair and health conditions of those people and was so moved that he came back after he left the military. He became a priest, and he decided to because he was a doctor as well, so what he wanted to do was help the people in the Amazon. So that's where our work started. Eventually, he bought a ferry boat and he sailed up and down moved up and down the Amazon offering healthcare, including surgeries, to the local people there.
Yeah, amazing. And you, Jerry, have been involved in local and national nonprofit organizations for more than 25 years. Give us a little thumbnail sketch of your background, but more interestingly, what brought you to Esperanza and why did you decide to take this role in 2017, did you say?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So I have spent my career in the nonprofit sector, national nonprofits, local nonprofits, and they've always been in the social service area. So when I came to Esperanza as an interim executive director, I was struck by the impact that we're making. So nonprofits struggle to make impact, but our impact is measurable. And I was also struck by the staff and the people that deliver our services. So I had a serious health challenge somewhere during that time period and realized that the people we serve don't have access to healthcare like I do, and their stories don't turn out good like mine did. And I wanted to make a difference for them.
Yes. I mean, I think the realization that so many people in the world live in radically different conditions than even some of the most disadvantaged people in urban America.
Yes.
Can be really eye-opening for people. Ana Ortiz, you're the International Program Director. How did you get started with Esperanza? Tell us a little bit about your background and what had you join the organization.
Well, I actually started with the organization back in 2013. That was like my first quote-unquote stint with Esperanza. I had just returned from finishing my service in Peace Corps in Panama. And I wanted to stay involved somehow in the global community, but also acknowledging that I didn't have a lot of formal skills to offer, but I wanted to be involved in public health. So I saw an opening for a surgical coordinator position at Esperanza, and I was like, well, I'll throw my name in and see what happens. And they, you know, interviewed me and liked me and brought me on board. So I was a surgical program coordinator part-time for 2 years at Esperanza, and I loved it. I loved the organization. To me, it was like the, it was Peace Corps, but in America. I got to be home and see my family more often, but I still got to offer, you know, this great service that at the end of the day, I felt really proud about. However, after 2 years of working there, I saw that if I really was to help the program and the organization move forward, that I needed more skills. I was, you know, kind of hindering myself and hindering the program. So I applied to a Master's of Public Health program at the U of A in Tucson. And, you know, unfortunately, that meant that I had to leave Esperanza. But I carried it in my heart, and I hoped that someday I'd be able to come back. I didn't know it was going to be so soon. But I, you know, when they flagged me down and said, hey, there's a position open, are you willing to come back? I'm like, yes, of course. And so I've been back with the organization since last February.
So you're bringing a wealth of experience and also perspectives to this. Can you talk a little bit more about some of the specific examples of the work that Esperanza is doing abroad, some of the specific projects so that people can really get a sense of the type of activities and benefits that are being provided to local communities?
So, for example, one of the projects that is near and dear to my heart is the water projects in Nicaragua. We are the organization that we work with in Nicaragua, AVODEC, has actually become somewhat of a regional expert in helping communities advocate for themselves and build their own access to water, to potable water. So they engage the community, they build up capacity within the community members to make sure that they have, you know, leadership amongst themselves to manage a water system after the community, after the organization, you know, kind of does its part and leaves them after the project is completed. They offer the technical knowledge it takes to actually build a water system, but all the labor is put in by its community members. And then, you know, at the end of the whole project, an entire community will have access to potable water at their home. So they'll have a spigot where they can just, you know, open it at any time of day and clean water will be coming out. And that is life-changing. I did a short study with some of these communities and spoke to the family members, most of them women, and most of them said, you know, I don't have to spend hours carrying water anymore, which means I can transform those hours into spending more time with my kids and taking care of them, helping them with their homework. I can spend more time at home. I can start a little side business, and I have pigs now, and I can feed them, and you know that brings in some extra income into my home. So it really is. It's a small thing, but it has a huge impact on a family's overall health and well-being.
I think people who are so take for granted that opening a tap and having clean water have no idea the significant amount of time and energy and in some parts of the world risk associated with simply getting water and not even clean water, just wet water.
Exactly.
Right? And the number of public health challenges that are a result of unsanitary conditions for which either the lack of water or the presence of contaminated water is a major challenge. The number of hours a day just spent carrying water. Think about it, people. If you've never thought about this before, water is heavy. If you need to put it in something to get it home, you either need to have a way of moving it or you need to make a lot of trips. If the place where you go to get the clean water is not nearby, you've got to get there and back on foot, on donkey, by truck, whatever. I mean, it's a very significant challenge. I want to come back to this issue of partnerships and talk a little bit more about that. But Maria Valenzuela, I want to bring you into the conversation as well. Talk a little bit about your background and then how you got involved with Esperanza and the domestic work.
Okay. So my background begins from, I don't know, probably since 1995. Oh my gosh. So anyhow, when I was going to school, I went in for family studies. And then I decided that I didn't know what family studies really meant. And so one of my first projects was to go and do an internship at a shelter. And so that's when I'm like, yeah, this is not for me. I just didn't have what it took to work in that capacity. So then I was offered a position at another nonprofit because they were in need of a bilingual person to start a school-based clinic. And so when I went in there, and then I worked with the families that I grew up with, I worked with the monolingual Spanish families, families of single parenting, families that had very limited resources for whatever the case may be. And I was able to identify with these families. I was able to understand their struggles and just to understand the simplicity of not, perhaps it's not simplicity, but not to be able to understand how to fill out an application that perhaps would assist a family and or a child just in the mind and the prevention of very basic healthcare. And for me to be able to help that family and for me to be able to make sure that there is a clinic, a site that these families can come to, that they don't have to worry about their child continuing to miss school because they don't know what to do. So that's where the passion of public health started for me. From there, I've moved on to other nonprofits and then I've been at Esperanza since 2000.
That's marvelous. Talk us through some of the community health programs you're providing here in the Metro Phoenix area. What sorts of services are available to people? What kinds of activities are you overseeing?
Sure. Some of the curriculas that we have put together, they're called Salud con Sabor Latino. And so we have Salud con Sabor Latino for adults, Salud con Sabor Latino para los niños, for children, and Salud con Sabor Latino para los años que cuentan, which are the years that count. Of course, all years count. But our senior population is a very, fairly new project for us. We've just began this year. And so we call it los años que cuentan because these are the years that the population that we service, they've struggled. They've had many struggles throughout the year. So these are the years that we want to come in into their lives and help them live a healthier lifespan for what they have left. And so we are able to provide basic nutrition information along with understanding the importance of physical activity and how to implement physical activity with the challenges that they have in their communities.
You know, it's a beautiful concept. I love that idea of los años que cuentan, the years that count, because in so many ways, those years can count for the community, not just for the individual. You must be bringing together generations in new ways. That must be fun to watch. Is that true?
Yes, absolutely. At the moment, we go into the HUD housing programming so that we can go and implement our curricula there. Somewhere down the line, and Jerry doesn't know a lot of my dreams.
It's no better time to
exactly.
To
by
tell.
The way, by the way, Jerry. She's like, okay, well, what list do you want? Where is it going to fall on your list? So I'm thinking in the future, we can integrate the children's piece with the seniors piece, because some of the research that I have done is that it does prolong the seniors' lives when children are integrated into their daily living, or at least into some activities. It also gives them a purpose. And then it also helps the children understand that age group as well.
You know, and I can imagine, I'm not as familiar with the parts of the world you work in, but having spent a lot of time in Africa and the Middle East, and then having some conversations quite a few years ago with my friend and former colleague from Oxfam, Joe Cox, who was unfortunately tragically murdered in the UK, this issue of loneliness and isolation, for aging populations is a big deal mm-hmm. all around the world. Mm-hmm. Even in communities that tend to have more close-knit relations between the generations. So in addition to the direct health benefits, there's, you know, what's sometimes called in the biz, psychosocial mm-hmm. benefits as well. People feel happier and when they're not as lonely and disconnected. Is that what you're seeing?
Absolutely. When we were approached to work with seniors, I said, sure, you know, I think because of my background and my culture and whatnot, I always assumed, which is not a great thing to do, I always assumed that our seniors stay at home with their parents or with, you know, the grandchildren or whatever the case may be. But that's not so much the case of the seniors that I work with. Although, by large, they are the Hispanic population that we work with. So the very first time that I walked into a senior center, I looked around and I was a little shocked, to say the least, because I never thought that in my culture we could have a building full of seniors whose children do not visit them, who they don't get to see their grandchildren on a regular basis. And it was very sad to me. And then it took me a while to understand that some seniors, this is what they want. Some seniors do not have children to help them, do not have anyone, and this is what they need. And so it's a reality, and also it's a positive thing that there are services there to help them, to lead them, and to help them live as much of a healthy life as they possibly can, despite the disparities.
Yeah. You've been working with Esperanza since the beginning of the domestic program.
Yes.
In 2000. So this is now, we're approaching 20 years of this type of work. For a nonprofit that was based on international missions, the kind that Jerry mentioned in the very beginning, the surgical missions, and obviously a lot of that work still continues, what was the thinking behind starting a Phoenix program, and how did that unfold?
That's a really great question. So the board members at that moment decided, you know, we're doing amazing things in other countries, but what are we doing in our own backyard? And so that was the question of that center, I guess. So that was a question of, you know what, let's do some research. What are the needs here in our own backyard? So after the research was done, there was back then very limited technology. So actually the research was all done by foot and questioning and whatnot. So they decided that there was 10 worst zip codes that people live in here in our own backyard in Phoenix. One of those zip codes happened to be on 67th Avenue in Van Buren. At that moment, there were still a lot of dairy farms and migrant workers in that area who did not have the very basics, such as there was no bus route in that area. There wasn't a clinic, or there were very limited. And because they're migrant farm workers, they were misplaced. You know, every season they'd have to leave, they come back or whatnot. So that's where we decided to start our project, because of that research of the 10 worst zip codes to live in Arizona.
Mm. That's Phoenix. Not a list anybody wants to make, right?
Absolutely.
We see sometimes the 10 most elites, you know, and of course there's the bottom 10 as well. A few weeks ago on the show, we had two representatives from Jewish Family and Children's Service, and one of the things they talked about is the issue of food deserts. Mm-hmm. Is that something that plays a role in your nutrition programming? Talk a little bit about that.
Absolutely. So the majority of the families that we service do live in food deserts. So what our job is to bring awareness, and to have them understand, because they hear food desert, but they don't really understand that. They're like, well, down the street, I can go and get ramen soup. But what does ramen soup, you know, really mean? And what are the nutritional values, which are not, they don't have nutritional values, where if we are able to have them understand that if you go a little bit further, you know, you can get fresh fruits and produce as what you want. So, or what they would need. So our job is to educate them on the importance of nutrition, how to read a food label, what does a healthy plate look like, without losing the cultural aspect to them. And so then we bring those resources to them. There are Fresh Express that can come out to their neighborhoods. There are, you know, for example, WIC does have a program where a lot of families may qualify for WIC, or they can go and take vouchers. So that is our job, to educate them about what is a food desert, why they exist, how can we survive in a food desert.
You know, it's, again, to me, who I've worked both domestically and abroad, I mean, this is a concept that is mind-boggling to people who don't realize that there are major areas of large cities where the only place to buy food is a gas station, or, you know, a corner store where everything is packaged and preserved and lives on the shelf. And the availability of fresh food, and of course, then the impact on health outcomes, if you live in an area where the only thing available, you know, comes from the same place where you put gas in your car, then people in that area's health is impacted by that. I'd like to return to this concept that you have all mentioned in various ways, and I think it's so critical to unpack a little bit. And that's the notion of working with and through partners, both, you know, here in the United States as well as abroad. Jerry, can you talk a little bit about the model of nonprofit service delivery and education and advocacy, and how partnerships play into all of that?
Yeah, so in our case, the partnerships, again, take place on two fronts. Would be domestically, where we reach out to other service providers in the communities where we serve, in addition to schools, community centers, HUD housing, Maricopa County Health Department. And we work with them because all of our services are delivered in the community. So we work with them to kind of piggyback on relationships they've already established, and then they piggyback on ours. So what transpires is this coordinated effort of service to the people that we're targeting, which is far more effective than one nonprofit taking it on by themselves. And then internationally, what we know is we don't want to be that parachute organization. We don't want to parachute into a community in any of the countries where we work in, say Nicaragua, and diagnose their problem, tell them what's wrong, and fix them. We want them to tell us what they need, and then we address those needs. So our local partner knows the community, has trust built with them, understands what their deficiencies are, and helps bridge that gap for us. So then we're able to very efficiently go in, work with our local partner, or fund our local partner to fund projects, just like Anna talked about the water projects in Nicaragua, but take a AIDS HIV project in Mozambique. We're able to help fund that project, and our local partner delivers it, which, again, far more efficient and more community-centric than us swooping in and doing it for them.
And vastly more sustainable as Correct. Well. I mean, one of the things that happens in the arena of international development is, you know, things make the news, they become a hot issue. Because organizations need to raise money to support their efforts, they are often pulled between, you know, trying to raise money for the established programs that they need to support while following the media story that's often, I mean, certainly for me, working in emergency relief, that's always been the challenge, and an ongoing conversation about forgotten crises in Africa or other places around the world. Of course, the needs everywhere outpace the funds, the resources, the trained and expert personnel. And I think one of the things most people don't realize is that the vast majority of the work done under this banner of international development, international relief, is being done by local experts in their own areas who may have been trained and sustained through a partnership with an international organization. But yes, the goal is to leave them doing the work.
Correct. Because if we swoop in and eventually, right, we have to swoop out. We have to exit. And either the community is ill-prepared to maintain what we've built, like in a water system case, or in Peru, we work with the Quiros Nation, 18,000 feet at the top of the Andes, and they have primitive living conditions. We have helped build some housing for them, but if their community isn't structured in a way for maintenance of what we've created, then it deteriorates and doesn't support the community. So the other thing that we're doing right now, I'm struck by your example of emergent issues. And Anna can talk a little bit more to this, but as you know, we've been hearing on the news about the Venezuelan refugees and what we into Colombia. And we have been discussing a partnership with another nonprofit in Chicago who's setting up infrastructure to provide medical services to those refugees. And we are looking at piggybacking with them to provide the surgical piece. So that's another example. We couldn't create the infrastructure on our own. But because we look to partnerships outside of ourselves, we're able to impact work that's emerging in another country that needs our help.
Yeah, I mean, it really is an issue of trying to find ways to work together better to achieve the goals that everyone has. Anna, anything you want to add on this issue of partnerships and how it plays out in your international work?
Well, I like to point out that it is one of the things that makes Esperanza so unique. It is one of the things that I'm most proud of. And I, in the way that I manage and work with the our partners, you know, that's where I pull the most integrity out of, is working with them and making sure that it keeps us on the right side of the balance. You know, it's always going to them and asking them, are you sure this is what you need? Like, we don't want to, you know, all of a sudden be dictating what's happening or what is a priority. So to me, it is extremely important to make sure that our partners are always vocal and present at the table, quote unquote, via Skype, in whatever decisions we're making. It's a very important piece of the work that we do.
You know, one of the things is everywhere in the world, the vast majority of decisions affecting families are being made by women. And so much of the traditional apparatus in the past of aid and support and development has been, in many ways, aimed at men, missing the mark. Certainly, a lot of the partnerships with host governments has introduced a layer of political elites into a conversation about how to support local communities, where in fact the actual decisions made that impacting the families are being made by women. How do you build this awareness into the delivery of your programs, into your outreach, into your community building?
So, and this is exactly why we work with our partners. In the countries where we work, in, for example, Peru or Nicaragua, they are actually way more at the forefront of gender roles than the U.S. is. So this is already built into the regular programming, and they kind of layer it into all the their other projects. So by, for example, I was talking about the water projects before. They'll have a training for community leaders about how to manage the water system, but then they also make sure that the representatives of the community are half men and half women. And then part of that training is also going to be, you know, making sure that the work is spread out evenly amongst all, that there is a level of respect to both men and women. The same goes for our partners in Peru. They're doing such great work in terms of gender roles and you know, making sure that there is a making sure that women and young girls as well are being respected and being treated fairly and equally at home and at school, you know, in all ways possible.
And when we were in Peru visiting with the Quiaros, in fact, we visited the community where we had built the housing, or were in the process of building the housing. And another community wanted us to come to see them. So we ended up, it was probably another mile on a terrible road, flooded. And again, we're up in this high altitude. And they put us in a big empty building, and we were meeting. And all the men were there, but the women were missing. And so the woman that does she's their community liaison, all the men got up and talked very eloquently about, they wanted us to come visit. They want us to build houses. They want what we're doing for this other community. And our community liaison, when we got back in the truck, she said, Jerry and Anna, She said, they're going to have to change their paradigm in order to be ready for us. Because before we'll even consider bringing a project into this community, we need to get their leadership set up. And more importantly, we need to get the women at the table. And she noticed that they were absent.
Yeah, I'm smiling over here because it's a scene that I have witnessed many times. You know, when you're doing site visits, when you're doing community assessments, when you're trying to figure out where are the most desperate needs so we can make, you know, wise choices about allocation of resources, funds,
right,
materials, expertise, et cetera, you'll often find the neighbors wanting to know, hey, how do we get some of that, right?
Yes.
And having to address this issue of having a balanced conversation. It's amusing to me. I've certainly seen that in my years as well. Maria Valenzuela, you oversee the domestic programs. How do these issues of gender equality and access and to the table, to the conversation, play out here in our own backyard?
Because here in our communities, it's the majority of the community members taking the classes or being interested in the classes are women. And so the men are usually working construction type of jobs. And so here, what we point out to the women and what they sometimes tell us is that we tell them, yes, your husband may bring the money, but you're the one in charge. And so we say, you're the one that makes the decisions on what food to buy. You're the one that makes the decision on how to buy that food and when to buy that food. So it gives them a little bit of empowerment because when they come to this country, they feel like they have lost their voice. Many of them think that coming into the United States, of course, it provides them better opportunities. However, they lose themselves. They lose their culture. They lose where they come from. They're trying to assimilate themselves into a different culture, even if they live in a predominantly Hispanic, Latino communities. But it's America now. It's the United States. So when we come to the classes, we tell them, you know, as I mentioned, okay, so you and your husband can talk about how you're going to spend your money, what it is that you're going to do. But in reality, husband comes in, here's money, whatever, the rent gets paid, bills get paid. But they're the ones that are making the choices of what foods to buy at the home.
Yeah, absolutely. You mentioned earlier, Maria, in when you were giving an overview of your programs, and I love this idea, your healthy living series called Salud con Sabor Latino, Health with a Latin Flavor. So the whole idea of building in cultural sensitivity, cultural appropriateness, and really serving people on their own terms is part of the programming.
Yes.
How does that play out in some specific ways? You know, what does that translate to in on the ground, as we say, in reality? What sorts of nuances would show up in that way? I mean, diabetes prevention is diabetes prevention, mm-hmm. but talk about diabetes prevention with a Latin flavor.
Yes, I'm glad that you bring that up because we are currently working on a new curriculum for diabetes for the population that we service. And yes, as a matter of fact, we met with an intern yesterday because we're working on two curriculums. I look at Jerry because she's like, what? When did that come about?
Right.
So we're working on two curriculums. One would be for gestational diabetes and one for the overall population. So when I was meeting with this intern, I said, you know, scientifically, diabetes is going to affect us. If we're diabetic, pre-diabetic, there are changes that we need to make. There are plenty of changes, you know. Is it medication? Is it diet? Is it exercise? Whatever the case may be. But being sensitive to where our population lives and what type of resources do they have to go and exercise? Do they have a safe park? Are there lights on their streets? Are there sidewalks on the streets? Can they go by themselves? Do they feel comfortable? Do they feel safe? Are there loose dogs? All of that needs to take into play, you know, so that when we present this information, we can give them options because we don't want to come in and say, oh, you know what? You just need to go for a walk for 30 minutes every day. Well, I can be told that, but I don't have a safe park to go to a walk. I don't feel comfortable in my neighborhood. Or I don't feel safe. So then, what are the other options? Also, when it comes to diet, a lot of our families, when it comes to diet, a lot of our families tell us, well, the doctor just said that I have that I'm diabetic, or that I'm you know, on the way to being diabetic, and I need to change my eating. What does that mean? So
right.
What does it mean to them is that they're not going to stop eating the tortillas. They're not going to stop eating the tamales, the tostadas, whatever the case may be. So what it means to them is that we need to educate them why they need to stop eating what they're eating, or reduce what they're eating, and bring in and introduce the healthier options that they do have. As Hispanics, coming from Mexico, we have great food. And we were accustomed to eating that food. But when we come to the United States, it's so convenient to just go to McDonald's and get a dollar burger than to go to the grocery store, reminding us that we live in food deserts. And it's not that convenient or easy to buy foods for salads. We can go to McDonald's and spend $6 on a salad, or buy a $1 hamburger. So our families, with the limitations that they have, we know what they're going to choose. So it's educating them and making the healthier choices that we once had when we lived in another country.
You know, you've said so many wonderful things. I just want to underline, because this is where the rubber meets the road, right? Sure, it's a good idea to go for a walk. Do you have sidewalks in your neighborhood? A lot of neighborhoods don't. Are there loose dogs? I mean, these are the daily realities. When you only have a limited amount of money to spend, buying a salad versus buying 8 burgers, and you've got multiple mouths to feed, these are tough choices. I'd like to talk a little bit about advocacy as we sort of head toward the end of this conversation. Advocacy works in multiple directions. On the one hand, you're working with communities and with community leaders, with community organizations, with partners to educate people on healthy options, on disease prevention, et cetera. On the other hand, as a nonprofit, you are also advocating, I would imagine, in other ways with donors, with state agencies, with other players in the space. So it kind of is going both ways. It's going down to the community and out or up to the larger infrastructure. How does that play out for Esperanza? Jerry, talk a little bit about this issue of advocacy.
I think in an advocacy sense, what we believe, so this is where our model comes into play. We advocate with our funders, with our donors, as you mentioned, with other organizations that do work, the same work in the communities we work, to really from a collaboration standpoint and a culturally sensitive standpoint. I think the missing link for most organizations is being culturally sensitive. And so as Maria and I have discussed many times, you know, there's a lot of organizations out there that want to talk access to care. And we're not in the business of giving insurance to our families. But what we are in the business of doing is helping with the barriers to access. So if I handed somebody who speaks Spanish, lives in the communities we serve, a fully paid insurance policy, they wouldn't have any idea what to do with it. So from an advocacy standpoint, how are we addressing the barriers to access? Not access itself, because that's being handled by government agencies, but the barriers to access. That would be socioeconomic status, education, language, location of where you live, zip code, all those things that we can actually do something about. And many of the organizations that serve in these communities, they fix problems as opposed to get in front of the problem to fix the problem from ever happening. And how do we do that? And that to me is the most important advocacy, is being able to speak to addressing the things that cause the problem rather than being in so late that you're only addressing the problem.
Ana Ortiz, you are the International Program Director. You oversee programs in a lot of different locations. So there are many layers to this work, from national governments to local governments to community leaders to the communities themselves. And you really have to get alignment and participation, buy-in, if you will, but more than just verbally. Like, it needs to be meaningful in some way for people to get on board and to actually execute the programs. What are some of the the challenges in doing that work? And also, what are some of the things that you've been surprised by that are good news in that regard?
Yeah, there are a lot of challenges when it comes to working with the different partners in different countries, you know, and especially because the countries that we work in are, you know, countries where the help is most needed. So that typically means that's where, you know, political instability may happen, crises, things like that. So we're going to the areas that other organizations potentially don't want to go. So that makes it difficult for us to get there, period, and to continue to work there in a sustainable manner. So that's challenge number one. How do we reach them and continue to reach them even through these difficult times, which is when they need us the most, not when they need us to leave? So that is challenge number one. Thankfully, we're small enough that we can be flexible with that. And I'm very grateful for that because we experienced that recently with Nicaragua. That was in the most recent past, Nicaragua was our strongest surgical program. They were accepting and hosting up to 14 surgical missions a year. That's a lot. And it was, we were relying a lot on our Nicaraguan partners to carry that weight for us. And then the instability and the crisis happened in April. And, you know, all of a sudden we were kind of caught off guard and not sure what to do. But because we're small and flexible, we've been able to kind of figure out ways to stay with our partners and support them throughout this time in different ways and in ways that they potentially need us more now. So, for example, what Jerry was speaking to now is in terms of getting ahead of the problem. This crisis brought on, you know, a lot of fear in people. It also brought on a lot of limitations in access of just regular everyday things, including healthcare. So people in the communities that we serve were not able to get to their closest health clinic. And when they did, the health clinic wouldn't be properly stocked. They wouldn't have all the medications or, you know, it wouldn't be stocked as frequently as it should. So even when the community members would leave, they wouldn't get the help that they needed. So what we were able to do in that case is with the staff that we already have on the ground, we started a primary care brigade program. So our staff nurse and doctor go out to the communities and provide primary care services in the communities themselves so that people don't have to leave their homes. They don't have to leave like their comfort zone, and they have a source to rely on now. I was talking to Dr. Morales just earlier this week, and he was saying how, you know, they visit these same communities every 6 to 8 weeks approximately. And they've started to see the same patients over and over again, just kind of as a follow-up. So he has kind of become the primary care practitioner for these people. Like he's their primary care physician now. You know, they rely on this service now, which is great that we can offer it, but it also kind of highlights the fact that, you know, they don't have that being offered by their own healthcare system. And what would happen if we all of a sudden weren't able to provide that? That would leave a huge gap. So it's, you know, it's been great that we've been able to provide this. And I think this is also showing us the wave of how important primary care is and helping us be in line more so with our domestic program as well. So we're trying to bring primary care more into our other programs as well. The surgical program is great and super impactful, and we've been able to do a lot of great work with it for many, many years. But having it exist in collaboration with a primary care program, I think, is going to make it even stronger and even more impactful for the communities that we serve.
Maria, how does this play out here in Phoenix, in the greater metropolitan area, the layers that you need to negotiate and work with and through as you're trying to implement these programs? What are some of the challenges, and also what are some of the heartwarming things you've seen?
How much time do you have? Some of the challenges is because we work with many school districts, and some of the challenges are getting the families involved, or Once they find out about us, it's like we're the hidden secret, you know, then everybody wants us to go and teach. And so obviously funding is always a challenge, because if we can, we utilize community health educators or community health workers. And so if we can have 10 community health workers to serve as educators and as advocates, our programming would be that much more amazing. But because of limitations, that alone becomes a challenge. And because of where we are located. So those are challenges, but to say the least, we have been around for 19 years. So somehow I'm overcoming those challenges, and along with this, our staff. So I think the success of that is the families, the stories that I hear. You know, I will admit, there is a time where I felt burnt out. I was just by myself, and I was utilizing a volunteer and training her. In 2013, up into 2013, I ran this program by myself. After just last year, our program grew by 4 additional staff. So it's amazing. And we still are having some challenges. But, you know, back in 2013, I was feeling like, is this what I really want to continue to do? It's hard. It's such difficult work. But at the end of a class, when I teach a class and a mom comes to me and says, you know what, I've been following everything that you've been telling me to do, and I went to see my doctor, and I no longer have to take my medication. I just, like, that was music to my ears, and think, like, I can never leave. That I'm not finished here. I still have to do this. Because, you know, this is one person that whose life changed, who does not have to take their medication, who does not have to stress about where to get the money for the medication, who can live a healthier and happier life for the family. This is the leader of their family. So we made a difference, not just in her, but in her whole family component. And to know that we're doing that in many communities here in our own backyard is over. I can throw me a challenge and I will figure it out. Not literally, but I have.
That's phenomenal. And yes, I think that personal struggle, the daily grind of doing good work in hard conditions with little resources, can take its toll. And thank you for continuing through that to where we are today. And obviously, there's so much more to do. This is never done. This is like the post office. You deliver the letters one day, and the next day, there they are. Again. They need to get delivered. Jerry Royce, president of Esperanza, talk in our final bit of this conversation here about the issue of fundraising. Obviously, nonprofits, live or die by the money they're able to raise from a variety of donors. There's a conversation, at least in the United States, it's been a few decades now, where ordinary people question at some level where's this money really go? All this kind of stuff. I think that some level is the wrong conversation, but it still is the one that a lot of folks have on their minds. And organizations like Charity Navigator and things exist to try to provide some guidance for people. Esperanza has a 4-star rating on Charity Navigator, which is the highest possible rating. But what is it you want people to really understand about their donations, about their contributions to yours and other organizations like this? What are the real issues, and speak to that, to the needs there?
Right. So nonprofits raise their money in a couple of ways. They raise them from institutions, foundations. Some nonprofits have government contracts. We don't. But there are a variety of institutional donors or givers, if you will. And then there's individual givers. And individual givers tend to give for one of two reasons. They either want the tax write-off, which with the tax legislation changes becomes less relevant for a lot of people, or they give because they want to make a difference and because they understand, and fundamentally they understand, that as a human being on this earth, we have a responsibility to reach out and help others. And you could do that through volunteering, through giving your services, that you could also do it through giving your money. And then the question is, who do I give it to, and how do I know that it's being used and properly? And we work really hard to tell our story. So we tell a lot of personal stories about clients that we serve, about Descota, who lives in Masian, Mozambique, who got her mother into a HIV support group. And she did that, and now her mother has a chance of living a longer life and raising her own six children instead of Descota being the one to raise her brothers and sisters. And that happens through an investment with our community partner, which comes from donors giving us money in order to do that. And so that's a real tangible benefit. I can say that program costs X, and you help support that. And whether it's the water projects in Nicaragua or the AIDS project in Mozambique, it's all of our, the majority of our dollars go to directly support our programs. We're probably 80, 90%, which is pretty good in the nonprofit sector, but also realizing that we have a strong infrastructure. So how do I know that my money's being used wisely? Well, we have a staff that's well qualified and skilled. We have an infrastructure that supports our work. We have strong community partners. We've been around for 49 years and in Phoenix for 20. We're not going anywhere. And so an investment in us is really an investment in the communities we serve. And donors can feel good about that money being used wisely.
You know, when somebody says, well, how much of the money is going to programs versus funding the administration? Part of why I think that's misplaced, misguided, is consider the alternative. Fill a cardboard box full of cash and drop it in the middle of a village.
Yep.
Come back a week later and see if you can figure out what happened. Here's what happened. The existing power relations in the village, the first person who got it kept it, or it was misappropriated or was something else. So in other words, there's always going to be a percentage of your money that helps to ensure the accountability of the entire thing.
Yep.
And, you know, nobody is, in most cases, most nonprofit leadership are not, living large off of their own salaries. Most staff and experts in the field are not lining their own pockets with it. The percentage of money that gets spent on administration is a percentage toward the integrity of the entire project. It's where the transparency, the reporting, the accountability, the expertise comes from, and it's an essential layer.
Yep.
And if you don't want to invest in real community results, feel free to give cash directly to somebody. That's also a viable alternative. It's just here you know what you're getting. You can come back later and you can look at the results. You know, it's all there.
That's an excellent point.
Yeah. Listen, I'm passionate about these things. Obviously, I could sit here and talk to you ladies all afternoon, but you have important work to get back to, so I don't want to keep you. Jerry, where do people go to learn more about the organization, about your programs, and about how they can contribute?
Yeah, so go to our website, esperanza.org, and that's spelled with a C, so it's a Portuguese spelling. That causes a little bit confusion with the Spanish version. The word means hope, and that's really the at the heart of what we do is provide hope to the communities we serve in. So esperanza.org will point you to more information about our programs, our partners, will allow you to donate, would give you information to our annual fundraising event. If you want to volunteer, we have lots of opportunities for that, from putting together dental hygiene kits we use in our Phoenix program, to sorting medical supplies that then get shipped to Nicaragua. And it's a great organization, a great group of people, and your involvement would be extremely meaningful to us, and I know meaningful to you.
That's marvelous. Thank you very much. Jerry Royce, President and CEO of Esperanza. Anna Ortiz, International Program Director. Maria Valenzuela, Director of the Domestic Programs. Thank you for the work you do, and thank you for joining us here in the studio today.
Thank you. We appreciate your time.
We appreciate you. For all of us here at Business Radio X, this is Dr. Adrian McIntyre, and we'll see you next time on Valley Business Radio.